Zachowanie go jeszcze, żeby się zamywać, że nie będę wypierany, mi się go połupać. Shri Ramayapur ki, Shri Mayapur Chandraday Mandir ki, Shri Panchatattva Bhagavan ki, Shri Shri Armarav ki, Shri Lakshmi Narasimhadev ki, Shambhavita Bhaktavinda ki, Srimad Bhagavat Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Shambhavita Bhaktavinda ki, Gopinandi Hari, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Gauranga, all glories to Shri Prabhupada, Namam Vishwaraya Krishna Prasthaya Buddhaya Shumara Bhaktivinoda Shamini Tinamini Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Charani. Nirvishesha Shunyavari Pashyat Chitesh Tarane. So, thank you very much for coming. And just for openers, since we are beginning the actual first chapter now, of our prepared material. Previously, the first 4 days of this class has been introduction. So, this chapter is called Relationship and Attachment. And this bhajan we have just sung is very appropriate to this topic. So, I just want to read the simple translation of this song, just to set us in the right frame of mind, by the grace of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. That mind, body and family, whatever may be mine, I have surrendered at your lotus feet, O youthful son of Nanda. In good fortune or bad, in life or death, all my difficulties have disappeared because I have chosen those lotus feet of yours as my only shelter. Slay me or protect me as you wish, for you are the master of your eternal servant. If it is your will that I be born again, then may it be in the home of your devotee. Let me be born again, even as a worm, as long as I may remain your devotee. I have no desire to be born as a Brahma who is averse to you. I yearn for the company of that devotee who is completely free of all desire for worldly enjoyment or liberation. Father, mother, lover, son, Lord, preceptor, husband, you are everything to me. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, O Kana. Kana is a very intimate way of addressing Krishna. It's kind of a nickname. So, O Kana, please hear me. O Lord of Radha, you are my life and soul. So, as is very evident from this translation, the theme is relationship and attachment. And we are hearing how Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has transferred attachment and relationship entirely to Krishna. So, another thing I want to do in the very beginning before entering into this chapter is just again read the five essential points which are the foundation of this entire course. And I'm going to do that whenever we begin a new chapter, just to kind of bring us back to the ground floor, because these five are stated very simply, and they're drawn. The first couple times I've read this, I've reminded you of the purport that I drew these five out of. This time I won't. If you're new here, please accept it for granted that these are drawn from Srila Prabhupada's purport, not drawn from my mental speculation. So, but this is what we're talking about in essence here. That number one, the essential substance of the mind is the mode of goodness, which is the energy of Lord Aniruddha, who is the localized supersoul feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Number two, when that sattvic mental substance is dedicated to the Lord, it is transformed to Krishna consciousness, the state of infallible goodness above the three modes of material nature. Three, to dedicate the mind to the Lord, we must channel the flow of our desires toward His lotus feet. Hence, there is no question of controlling the mind, fixing the mind, pacifying the mind, without reformation of desire. Our quality of mind is subject to the quality of our desire. And just to make a little parenthetical comment on this, in case it didn't come out clearly in the introduction, the reason the quality of our mind is subject to the quality of our desire is that desire is actually more subtle than the mind. You see, because as we've explained several times in the introduction, desires come from a deeper, it's also included as the mind, but it is called the subconscious or unconscious. It is a place we work with our surface awareness, and we have no real way of getting down to the basement of our mind, where most of what we know as the Atman, the self, is. Most of the self is buried under Tamishra, total ignorance, and we have no way of getting down there, and that's where our desires are coming from. So therefore, they're just popping up into our surface awareness, and until we seriously take to the yoga process, which ultimately means bhakti yoga, we have no way of getting control over our desires. You can't do it simply by force of will combined with the conscious mind. It's impossible. And then the next point, number four, is that from the logic of the above point two, which just says that the sattvic mental substance of the mind when dedicated to the Lord is transformed to Krishna consciousness. So if you reverse that logic, if you just, instead of going from front to back, go from back to front, then it is clear that the original condition of the mind is Krishna consciousness. This is very important. That original condition is contaminated as soon as our desire flows towards the lording over of matter. If it wasn't for our desires flowing in the wrong direction, our mind would be our best friend. It wouldn't give us any trouble. And then the last point is that what we know, thus, iti, as you say in Sanskrit, iti, thus, what we know to be, quote, the material mind, unquote, is in essence the condition of material attraction. That's what the mind, when we talk of the mind as a material thing, it is our attraction. The essence of it is our attraction to this material world. So these are the five fundamental principles of our whole seminar. And today, unless we have questions, because we reserve the front part of our class for questions, because we expect these questions will be serious, because especially today, since today is Monday. So if you have any questions in your mind, that means you've thought about it the whole weekend, so they've got to be real serious questions. And so we are eager for serious questions. So if you have any questions from anything that's gone before, or anything that was within the framework of our subject, please ask that now. Yes?
Well, you know the brain, the way the brain is divided, is there like a spiritual side to the brain or a material side?
Well, I think you're new here, are you not?
I'm coming, but I've been late, and I've been sitting at the back.
But you've been coming since the beginning?
Not from the beginning.
Yeah, because this question did come up. And you see, the brain is an instrument, the brain is an organ of the body, which is the central organ of the nervous system. The entire nervous system. So, but that is the nervous system in its gross appearance. Actually, in Vedic science, there's also understanding of a nervous system, but the nerves are called nadis. Those are the subtle channels of prana, which flow all throughout the body, carrying consciousness, along with the blood. So, you see, in Ayurveda, then, what is a nerve and what is a blood vessel? These things have somewhat different definitions than they do in modern Western medical terminology. So anyway, the brain is certainly the chief organ of the nervous system, and Srila Prabhupada used to talk about, for example, we find in Gita about the necessity of developing finer brain tissues. So the brain certainly has something to do with consciousness. But the brain is not the mind. The brain is certainly not consciousness. The brain is a material lump which is used by consciousness. So accepting that the brain is itself perishable matter, we cannot really logically talk about a spiritual part of the brain. You know,
they do designate certain parts of the brain to certain functions.
Yes. But if you say, you see, this is an atheistic argument that they sometimes give. The scientists more and more today are having to admit that spirituality or religion is a component of human nature. And yet they don't want to let go of their past materialistic theories like evolution and so on, of how human nature came to be. So therefore they say that somehow religious practice was conducive to survival. So therefore it has become wired into the brain, although they haven't found the place yet where that is. But this is what they say, that religion is wired into the brain. So on those terms, you see previously, so like when we were talking about Freud, for Freud there was just no place for religion in science except as something to scoff at, as something to sort of, you know, throw into the garbage. But now scientists, you know, they've recognized the failure of materialistic science to turn everyone into a into a deterministic robot, a machine made of flesh. They see that religious sentiment is still alive and well, as it always has been. So now they've come around saying, all right, if you can't beat them, join them, but join them on our terms. Religion is somewhere in the brain hardwired, and it's necessary for survival. And then they give, you know, they always do this fanciful backtracking of how religion came to be, you know, after some picanthropus tribe killed a woolly mammoth. Then they danced around it or something and sang some songs, and, you know, as a result of that, somehow they found it better, you know. whatever. I don't even want to get into it. It's so insane. I had once, when I was on the BBT library party, I had one. I knew this guy was far out when I looked at his door, all the stuff hanging on his door. He was a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And I just knew that this is going to be something interesting, because he had all these wild decals and pictures and weird stuff on his door. And sure enough, when I knocked on the door, this total freak opened, you know, with beard and long hair, and he was grubby. You know, he really looked grubby and dirty, a beatnik, you know, real beatnik. And he was a professor. And so he just started, we were showing him the books, and he just started giving his own view on the origin of the Vedas. And that was that, the Aryans, after they, you know, came from the Caucasian mountains and invaded India, then after they conquered the local people, the brown-skinned people, then they had a big party, a big celebration, and they drank psychedelic mushroom juice. This it's called the fly agaric mushroom, which I think is also available in the Himalayas, so they pressed it up. And that's where soma comes from, and they got all intoxicated on this stuff and started hallucinating, and they hallucinated Indra and Brahma, and they wrote it all down. And it's all the result of a big psilocybin trip. You know, psilocybin is the active ingredient of mushrooms. It's a hallucinogen like LSD. So in other words, the whole Vedas just came out of a big psychedelic experience. And he seriously told me that. And of course, to sell the books, you can't insult people. But I was thinking, you know, only a person who himself is taking a lot of drugs could say something like that. You know, the Vedic scripture is such fine, beautiful language, you know, poetic language. It could not have been written by someone stoned out of his head, you know, because you can't even pick up a writing instrument when you're so stoned. You just look at it, you know, it's all different colors crawling all over your field of vision. So, totally absurd. But this is what they do, according to their own point of view, Atmavan Manyate Jagat, according to their own prejudices. Then they try to explain things like the religion and Vedas. So, in short, the brain is an instrument up here that is used by the mind that is actually located here. Just like in a computer. What are you dealing with when you use a computer? You're dealing with the keyboard, you're dealing with the mouse, you're dealing with the display. None of those things are actually essential to the operation of the computer. What's essential is deep inside the microprocessor, the software, this stuff you don't see. So in the same way, the mind is in the heart, you don't see it, but images from the mind are projected up into the... they're displayed up in the brain. So you can clearly see that when you use a computer. You relate to the screen, you see. You just look at the screen. And for people who don't know much about computers, except, you know, how to type, you know, that's all they think about. It's a screen and keyboard, you know. That to them is a computer. But the real guts of the computer, you know, is inside. And if they were to look at that, they would have absolutely no idea what's going on.
You know, I asked you that question, but someone told me that the right side is more associated with material than the left side, spiritual.
Well, they have these theories. They have these theories, but maybe Nitai wants to go into that at some point. You see, we're working together on this. So I've written this material on the Bhagavad explanation of the mind because I feel it's very important for devotees to understand this. I was just talking with a GBC God brother this morning, and he was telling me, he said, actually in the world today, mental health is becoming the foremost problem. You know, things like depression and so on and so forth are being recognized by the United Nations as among the foremost health problems of the world today. And he said that is also within ISKCON too. More and more devotees are having problems, you know, up here and in here. And he admitted, he said, the same old recycled preaching of Jai Prabhu, go out and distribute books Prabhu, you know, be enthusiastic Prabhu, it's having less and less effect. You know? So, and some devotees make the unfortunate mistake of thinking, well, because they hear classes like this again and again, that in our books there really isn't no psychology. But that is a, I said, mistake. That is a very tremendous, tremendous mistake. And so what I did was I wrote, based mainly on Srimad Bhagavatam with some side references to like other Vaishnava sources, Sripad Ramanujacharya in particular, whom Prabhupada praised for his insight into the mind and the senses and of the human being and their relationship to the original mind and senses of the Lord. I start off, before going into Ramanuja, with this purport. I'll read it to you when we get to that part, so you'll see that it is bona fide. Nothing to worry about. But Prabhupada himself so often quotes Ramanujacharya, but I did research. Ramanujacharya has given a very, very, very substantial outline of psychology in terms of bhakti. Very substantial. It's very... Nitai Gauranga Prabhu, when he saw it, you told me you were very impressed by it. Yeah. I mean, he's trained in modern psychology, has a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Massachusetts. So he was very impressed. It's very sophisticated and completely centered on bhakti. And by understanding this system of Bhagavat, Bhakti Yoga psychology, you can understand why Bhakti Yoga is the highest yoga system compared to Karma Yoga or Jnana Yoga. I've already explained that. I'm not going to get into that now. So Anyway, these theories are there, perhaps Nitya Gauranga will address them, perhaps not. But our main purpose here is to provide you with this Bhagavat Science of Mind is the name of the course. That will give you enough food for thought so that you won't worry so much about, you know, the left half, right half of the brain and all these things coming from Western psychology, which are, they may be interesting, but ultimately not very helpful for devotees in solving our problems. You see, why has the Bhagavatam... You see, the thing is that we overlook, we don't see what's right in front of us when we're reading the Bhagavatam. That there's a very extremely detailed, extremely profound, when we get into the topic of depth psychology. The Bhagavatam has an extremely deep and profound and extremely detailed explanation of what in today's terms is called depth psychology. So we want to give you this to think about. A few years ago there was a lot of one person in particular who, thank Krishna, is no longer so prominent, but this person was pumping a lot of Western psychological ideas into the ISKCON context through the internet, through the what's now called PamHoNet. And then there was a counter attack against that, which I was discussing with Nitai before. There were devotees who then started to launch an attack against psychology. There's no place for psychology. But the Bhagavatam has so much about psychology. We just have to understand it, you see. And then we have our own bona fide parampara, completely approved by Prabhupada's system of psychology, already there. The problem is that all of that is in the parts of the Bhagavatam that we most tend to quickly, you know, oh, now all this tattva, because it is interwoven with the description of creation in Canto 2 and 3, and the Sankhya philosophy of Canto 3, and difficult things in the 7th canto and 11th canto in particular. Those parts that we tend to rush through, get to the next lila, get to the next story. Oh yeah, so now here's a story. We like the story. So that's why I said, you know, here in this class, we're not keeping gloves on when it comes to tattva. We want to help you to understand it. We don't want to beat you on the head with it, so that you get dizzy, you know, so many things to put together. We want to make it as clear as possible. We want, if necessary, we'll take you by the hand and walk you through it. But we are going to go through it, all this tattva, so that you will, at least, we want everyone, like I remember I had a teacher who was teaching European history, and he started the semester by putting one number on the board, 1066, in huge letters. He said, at the end of this semester, if this is all you remember, this date, 1066, which is when William the Conqueror invaded England, then I'll be satisfied. So I'll be satisfied if you can at least leave this knowing that there is an extremely sophisticated system of psychology in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and that you don't have to wander afield. Of course, Nitai is going to take you into these other... He already explained Freud, and today he's going to explain Jung to you. But this is all in the context of Bhagavad philosophy. So it'll be, you know, digestible for you. So anyway, we don't want to take a lot of time. We want to give him enough time, because he has a lot to say about Freud, and he's very enthusiastic, and I want to keep him enthusiastic because his contribution is very valuable to our class. For the next several days, we're going to be talking about relationship and attachment, which is so essential to psychology. So we're presenting a philosophy of mind, a system of psychology that comes entirely from the point of view of Vaishnava Siddhanta. Every element of this presentation is directly or indirectly. We can say what Nitai is presenting is, a lot of it is indirectly, but it is related. It is related to Srila Prabhupada's teachings. Otherwise, what's the point of bringing it up? Just like we talked about Freud, the pros and cons of Freud. There's, of course, a lot of cons, but there are some pros that Prabhupada said. His drive theory that underlying every, all human affairs is the sex drive coupled with aggression. Eros and Thanatos in Greek. Sex and aggression. Or you very brilliantly brought in that verse from Gita, Icha Dvesha. Icha Dvesha Shamutina Dvandva Mohina Bharata. Krishna says everyone is bewildered by the duality of Icha means desire and Dvesha means envy. So you can see there's I remember talking with a god brother of mine who almost got an MA in psychology. And we were talking, he's really studied Freud deeply. We had a long talk about Freud because I was interested to know more about Freud. And we both came to the conclusion, we both, after talking about it, we sort of sat back and said, the guy must have been one of these atheistic Brahmins in his last life. He must have been a Brahmin with a lot of insight into Sankhya philosophy, because Sankhya philosophy deals with the mind too, and the senses, the three modes of material nature, its effect on the mind. But atheistic Sankhya philosophy completely rejects God. So he must have been one of those fellows who took birth in the West as punishment. That was his punishment. He took birth in Vienna, in a Malecha family. But he actually did have a lot of insight, you see. But unfortunately, it was all rendered demoniac because of his obsessive atheism. He was an obsessive atheist. He really wanted to use psychology, psychoanalysis as a weapon against religion in the world. And that's why Prabhupada said he's one of the three big demons of the modern era, along with Karl Marx and Charles Darwin. But even Freud, indirectly, you see, we bring him in indirectly in connection with Prabhupada's teachings. So you may find that all this information that we're presenting, the philosophical insights, difficult to absorb. So we're sorry if we're taxing your brain, but we're trying to at the same time build one step on another so it won't be too hard for you. So you have to expect that understanding these things is going to be more difficult in the beginning, because it's new. But step by step, if you just stay with the class and go on hearing, and as we can build one concept on another, and as you become more familiar with the issues, then the subject matter is actually going to become easier. This is the bright, there's light at the end of the tunnel. As we go on, it's going to become easier, not harder. So this is especially true of Vedic psychology, which starts with principles. You see, Vedic psychology starts with principles, which are harder to grasp. You see, principles, I may use the word abstract principles, are harder to grasp. And then we progress from principles to behavior, to understanding behavior, which is easier to grasp, because behavior you can see. It's evident to our senses. Whereas Western psychology proceeds oppositely. It tries to uncover principles by starting with a study of behavior. This approach tends to lead one deeper and deeper into confusion. Now, we discuss, myself and Nitai, what we're going to do in these classes beforehand, privately. And so he wanted me to explain this. So, because he asked the question of me, then I think it's important that I explain this to you, why I wrote this. I wrote this actually as a result of one of these conversations I had with my nearly MA in psychology, godbrother. And he told me that in Western psychology, there are minimum six main schools, six or eight, depending on how you divide them. But he said at the very minimum, there are six main schools of Western psychology. And naturally, why do they exist? Because their founders and the followers of those founders are in deep disagreement with the other schools. So each school is thinking we're right and the others are wrong. And so right there you have confusion. And he told me, basically, what psychologists do is they observe human behavior. They run repeated tests. You know, they create a situation and they have, say, 100 people, you know, students or whatever, and they bring them into a situation. Like, he told me of one test. This is rather getting on... Actually, one devotee, he was talking to me this morning, and he said, I like this about when you talk. You're not afraid to say things that are a little controversial. So this is one of those things. Just a little controversial. Little controversial. But as a example of the kind of test that modern psychologists do, he told me of one test in which they installed, I guess with the permission of the university faculty, they installed a hidden camera into the washroom, toilet room. But just the tech camera was focused on the wash basin. So they were studying to see how many students washed their hands after they went to the toilet. You know? And then this gets, you know, analyzed and then incorporated. It becomes more data that fits to some theory, you know, in one of these schools, you see. So, and he said, this is the way psychology proceeds. This is what he told me. And so I took him as an authority. If you start with behavior, it seems easier. But if you don't have principles, that's a thing in psychology, that they say in philosophy too. That you can understand and explain principles of philosophy with logic. That's all right. But you can never arrive at principles through logic, you see. Principles are always established by founders of schools, just like this Platonic philosophy. It goes back to an acharya, I mean, to use the word perhaps loosely, although Plato is one of the better Western philosophers because he did accept the existence of an eternal soul and, as they say in Greek, metempsychosis or reincarnation. He did accept these things and God, some kind of semi-personal concept of God. Not exactly impersonal nor exactly personal either. You'd have to best say semi-personal. So there's a whole school, a British philosopher of recent times, A.N. Whitehead, he said all of Western philosophy is just footnotes to Plato. So Plato, Platonic philosophy, is still today the trendsetter for all philosophy. And it comes from a person named Plato. It wasn't that a committee got together and, you know, they talked, and they just talked and 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 by logic and reasoning came up with these principles that were known as Platonic philosophy. No philosophy has ever been made like that. There was always some genius, either an enlightened genius or a demoniac genius, but some kind of, you know, genius person. Like Nietzsche is an example of a demoniac genius. He was a genius. He was such a genius, he finally drove himself insane and got locked up in a nut house. But he actually was, when you read Nietzsche, a lot of what he says is true. And I had another godbrother, French godbrother, who was a good friend of mine. I haven't seen him for years. He lives in Australia now, but he's originally French, and French have a tendency to philosophy. So he said, my material nature, he used to say, my material master is Friedrich Nietzsche, my spiritual master is Srila Prabhupada. Because Nietzsche is so, he was such a negationist, you know. So in that sense, you know, when you're done with Nietzsche, you're done with the material world, you know. And Nietzsche very much influenced Freud too. Freudian psychology has a lot of roots in Nietzsche. So anyway, so it's the same thing. In Vedic psychology, we begin with principles which start with persons, you see. Start with Krishna, first of all. And then Brahma is the agent of Lord Krishna's creation. And what Brahma created is simultaneously because he creates by Vak, Shabda Brahma, Vak Shakti. So that is his enunciations, the mantras that he recites, the Bija mantras that result in everything we're experiencing, because sound is behind everything, sound and ether, Shabda. That manifests as the Vedas, the Vedic knowledge. The blueprint, Prabhupada said, he didn't use the word blueprint, but he said just like when you get some instrument, electronic instrument like a dictaphone, then there comes some booklet that tells you how to use it. So similarly, this whole universe comes with a user's manual, which is the Vedic scriptures. Yeah? So this starts with principles. And then we apply our logic how to, in terms of desha, kala, patra, time, place, circumstance. There's a place for logic. We don't say kick out logic, throw away the mind like the Mayavadis do. That's really against, as I've explained several times, the mood of this class. We want to learn how to use the mind properly in Krishna's service. So, let's continue. So, now we're going to be talking about relationship, attachment, and this is bringing us closer to behavior, you see. We're getting nearer to behavior now. We're actually getting, yes, involved in behavior. But we're always going to be more concerned with how to see oneself than what oneself should do. You see, this we put more stress on in this class. How we should see ourselves, how we should remember that we are spirit soul, not the body, and that the mind is an energy of the Lord. Because what to do, I mean, if you've been a devotee, you've learned what to do, what not to do. But now we want to learn in this course why that is right. You see? Because if you just learn, do this, don't do this. Well, we all learn those kind of things from our parents, right? You know, parents would say, I mean, it's a famous thing. I had my parents, fortunately for me, they didn't smoke. But I had a friend whose both parents were just, you know, they constantly puff, 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 puff. And they used to tell him, don't smoke. So naturally he didn't see any reason why not to smoke. Because my gurus are telling me not to smoke, but they are smoking. So let me follow the achar rather than the prachar. Achar always is seen first. Behavior. So this is what we try to do in this course too. To understand the why of things. So, I personally think of Vedic, of Vaishnava or Vedic psychology really as meaning self-realization. Which for a devotee means spirit-soul realization or eternal servant of Krishna realization. Srila Prabhupada said realization means discrimination. When one is self-realized, he is blessed with proper discrimination in all kinds of practical affairs. That's why we're not in this course going to be so much concerned with the details of behavior. What should I do in this situation? There are other venues for that. But our concern is how to be self-realized, how to be Krishna conscious in all situations, especially when your mind is totally going nuts, which it often does, you know. How to still be Krishna conscious. So, a major theme of this first chapter, which is relationship and attachment, because before we were just doing the introduction. So, major theme will be one Sanskrit word, which is anyonya. Now, anyonya in Sanskrit is a contraction. Just like, it was interesting to find out that not all languages today have this phenomena of contraction. But at least in English, there are also contractions. Like instead of saying cannot, you can say can't. There's a way to to conjugate two words, can not, into one word, can't. Will not, won't, you see. So similarly, in Sanskrit, anyonya is a contraction of anyaha anya, which literally means other. Two persons, or it means there's two. And they're distinct from one another. Mm-hmm. It crops up repeatedly, this word, anyonya. If you do a search for this word, if you have database on your computer, you'll be amazed how many times it appears in the Bhagavatam. From Srila Prabhupada's word-for-word translation from different verses, we see that anyonya can mean one after another, each other, or one another. In essence, this is a word about relationship. And it comes up again and again in different contexts in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, relationship, I will say, and I will give Nitai Gauranga the freedom to agree with me or semi-agree with me or disagree with me when it's his turn to talk, and just now coming, before 5 o'clock, he will be talking. But relationship, to me, as I've understood it, is the central issue of psychology. As I was writing this, I had before me a book by an American psychiatrist, and he began the prologue of the book with a Yiddish proverb. Yiddish means Jüdische Deutsch. It's the German that was spoken by the Jewish people. It's a kind of Jewish dialect of German, Yiddish. So there's a lot of German in Yiddish, but there's also a lot of Hebrew, sort of street Hebrew in it. So anyway, he put in a translation, English translation of the Yiddish proverb that, quote, the one wishes to remember, the other wishes to forget. Here we have one another, anyonya. You see? So this psychiatrist, he crystallized his book into this one statement. One wishes to remember, one wishes to forget. So now analyze conflicts between people. Usually, that's what it's about. One wishes to remember something, you know, that the other one did to him, and the other one wants to just forget about it. Right? I mean, so many arguments are about that. Last year you said this to me. I don't remember that. No, you said this to me. Don't try to dodge out of it. You insulted me. No, I didn't. You misunderstood. Forget about it. I won't forget about it. Isn't it? So many times. So, but this even applies to a single individual. Even inside yourself, we have a dialogue going on within ourselves. And one part of ourself wants to remember something from the past. And another part wants to forget it. Oh God, no, I don't want to remember that. No, 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 no. No, you did this, you did it. No, no, don't remind me, please. You see. So according to the Western disciplines of psychiatry and abnormal psychology, the condition of neurosis, actually, if you weren't here, if you haven't been here earlier, then would someone please tell this nice devotee that this is not appropriate, that he plays mridanga at the top of the stairs while we're having this class. This is what I mean. Anonya, other. Yes, he has a different idea. So this is called, yes, even a single individual can be torn by opposition between one another, and this is called mental conflict. One part of us wants to remember something, another to forget. According to Western disciplines of psychiatry and abnormal psychology, the condition of neurosis, which Nitai Gauranga previously explained, you may have been here, may not have been here to hear that. But neurosis includes anxiety states, obsessions, hysteria. He explained what hysteria is. All of this is rooted in mental conflict. So now, I'm turning the floor over to Nitai Gauranga, who has 35 minutes.
I really don't need that much time.
You don't need that much time? Well, we'll continue if you don't need that much time. But he's going to tell us all about Jung and the difference. He told us about Freud. Now he's going to tell us about a person who used to be, started off as Freud's disciple, but broke away. And he will tell us, I'm sure, the reasons for that break and what Jungian psychology is and how it's different from Freudian psychology. Mm-hmm.
So the Maharaj is speaking about the central point in Vedic psychology being of interpersonal relationship. And so Freud's idea wasn't necessarily of that at all. Actually, Freud's idea was more that we're really just products of our instinctual drives, and the best thing we can do is somehow redirect that energy that comes from our internal drives and make something somewhat worthwhile and half human out of us at best. You know, otherwise we become just wanton animals. But a lot of Freud's followers or disciples, what have you, tended to focus more on this idea of interpersonal factors being of a greater, what's the word I'm looking for? Greater
bearing?
Yeah, have a greater bearing on one's psychology. So this is what formed what's now called psychodynamic theories, as opposed to Freud's psychoanalytic theories. So we can say in a nutshell, Freud's psychoanalytic theories is based on the id, on the instinctual drives of sex and aggression, and that the psychodynamic theories are based on the ego, on the personality, and on the personality's striving for something to be, for progression. Freud's theories were based on the intrapsychic workings of the mind, how the instincts of the id are pushing against the ego, and the overbearing voices of the superego are trying to thwart the attempts of the id to achieve its desires. And psychodynamic theories focus more on the ego and the personality striving for something greater than just the mechanical pushes and pulls of the id. Psychoanalytic theory is largely mechanistic in that it considers the past, how the past it relates to causes. The things that happen in the past are directly responsible for what happens in the current state. And psychodynamic theories are what we call teleological. They're related to the future. What happens in our current situation is actually related to the end, is actually related to our desires and what we want to become. So now with Freud's followers moving into an ego-focused psychology, the focus is away from the id and now on the ego, but not just on the ego as the regulator of the pushings of the id, which is still a function of the ego, but now also what they call the autonomous ego. That person, that individual, ourselves, really, that strives for something better, that strives for progression. And they want to say that this aspect of the ego is more important. So of those Freudian disciples that broke away from Freud to a greater or lesser extent, the one that I want to talk about, and perhaps the one who's most important for in terms of Vedic psychology, in that his model of psychology just very much lends itself to Vedic thought and actually is largely derived from Vedic thought, and that's Carl Jung. So Carl Jung was the son of an Episcopalian clergy member, and as a child he was quite introverted. He said that he didn't speak much to other kids when he was growing up because he felt that no one would understand his internal thought process. So he didn't really have many friends. And actually what he did was he carved a little man, a 4-inch tall man out of wood, and would speak to this little man. And apparently the man would speak back to him. So this was his best friend when he was growing up.
Did it look like Lord Jagannath?
I'm not sure exactly what he looked like, but so he had this little man friend. His family was quite intellectual, and he also became quite intellectual, and he learned a number of languages growing up when he was in school. Actually, one of them was Sanskrit, and he translated a lot of Vedic literatures, and would often quote different Upanishads in his books, and his books are quite wild. A lot of them are quite wild, and it's really suggested if you want to understand Jung, you should read him through a secondary source, because to read him straight is quite difficult. But I've read books of his where he's quoting from Upanishads, and you really can't figure out what he's getting at, but it seems real neat anyway. So Jung went to medical school, became a psychiatrist, and was working in a psychiatric hospital, and he was reading some of the works that were being published by Sigmund Freud. So he contacted Freud. Freud suggested that he come to... Where was he then? I guess he was still in Vienna at that time. So Jung went to go visit with Freud, and it said that on their first meeting they spoke for 13 hours straight, and then Jung was officially became a member of the Psychoanalytic Institute. And after a short time, Jung was seen as was going to be the successor of Freud. He was Freud's best disciple. And after a couple of years, there started to become a rift between them. It started when they were on a trip to America. Freud was giving a lecture in America. And they were interpreting each other's dreams. And so Jung was giving some very he was giving some very interesting interpretations of Freud's dreams that he was telling him, and Freud became very uncomfortable. And Freud was a very hard-headed and authoritarian type of figure, and he saw that actually Jung understood maybe a little too much about him. And so he told him he had to stop immediately with the interpretation of the dreams, and that Jung was very hurt by that. And then later Jung published a paper that Freud didn't agree with and didn't want him to publish. So Jung was then ostracized from the psychoanalytic community. And for a period of 15 years, he went into I don't know if you would call it quite a depression, but a very difficult stage of his life. For 15 years, he was largely alone, and was having experiences that were borderline psychotic, and he was having a lot of visions of things that he thought were going to happen in the future, and a lot of really wild dreams that he was interpreting. And during this time, he was actually visited a number of times by some metaphysical being that he said in one place that this is what the Hindus refer to as a guru. So he had this kind of metaphysical guru guy coming and telling him things. But in the end, he said that if you want to understand a jungle, you can't look at it from the periphery. You have to enter it, regardless of how frightening it might be. So he felt that this time of delving deeply into his oftentimes strange and frightening internal world, that he was able to understand in a very intimate way psychology. And so from that 15-year period, he reemerged and started his own school, and maybe as a little, you know, gesture to Freud, called it, Freud's school was called psychoanalysis, and his was called analytical psychology. So, there you go, Freud. So we can start with Jung's model of the mind. I'm going to use the blackboard again, and you're going to look at my horrendous handwriting and try to decipher it, and it'll be a big problem. So if we remember, there is Freud's model of the mind, and here you have the ego, and here is the superego, and here is the id with all of its desires for sex and aggression. So Jung's model was similar, and the ego was in the same place, and the conscious and unconscious parts of the mind functioned largely in the same way, but here you have the ego, and then right underneath the ego you have what's called the personal unconscious. And then underneath the personal unconscious you have what's called the collective unconscious. And the force that animates the ego is called libido. In Freudian terms, libido specifically means sexual energy. In Jungian terms, libido just means psychic energy, the energy that animates your mind. So, we'll go from there.
So, the libidinal energy, the energy of the libido, works kind of as a wave, or maybe in a circular motion. And so for a while, it's giving energy to the ego, to our conscious selves, to our selves that want to progress. And then as a wave goes in and out, it'll nourish that part of ourselves and then recede into the personal unconscious and give energy to the desires that are in the personal unconscious. Let me see here. Let me proceed from here. So the dynamics of what Freud and Jung refer to this as the psyche, not as the mind per se, but he referred to it as the psyche. The psyche has some principles that operate the dynamics of it. The first one, and the main one, is called the principle of opposites. That is to say that a desire or thought is evidence of its opposite desire or thought. So if in our ego, in our conscious waking state, we have a desire, it's understood that within our personal unconscious, we have the opposing desire. And then the second principle is called the principle of equivalence. That this is also based on the principle of entropy. The principle of entropy is that if energy is equally distributed, then it goes down. This is a principle of physics. The principle of equivalence states that if energy is given to both sides of our personality, both sides, or at least an understanding is given that we have a desire, but we also have the opposing desire. If that's acknowledged, then the energy goes down. So equivalence, an equivalence in understanding or appreciation of the aspects of our personality. Now the principle's opposite states that opposing the idea of entropy, that when energy is evenly distributed, then it goes down, that when energy is not evenly distributed, then tension will rise. So in this case, we can say that if someone has a desire, that's evidence that they have an opposing desire. Now, if someone doesn't acknowledge that opposing desire, or in some cases doesn't foster in some way, shape, or form that desire, the opposing desire, that is, then that will create a tension. And I think I think we've all in the Krishna consciousness movement have seen this in the, you know, the young, you know, enthusiastic devotees who are going to be brahmacharis for the rest of their lives and are you know, sneering and spitting on the women and are convinced that they'll never ever get married, and then, you know, they're the same people that, you know, 5 years down the line you meet, and they're, you know, anyway, you know, I chant sometimes and you know, it's cool. So this is an example of the principle of the opposites, that due to the lack of recognition of the opposing desire, and further that that an increased desire is suggestive of an increased opposing desire. So to the extent that someone is fanatical, going to kill women if he sees them, to that extent there is some serious, anyway, stuff going on in the opposite side.
Could I just ask a question, clarification?
Mm-hmm.
So, hearing you, then I think of in the Gita where Krishna is speaking of samadarshana, that one should come to a sage comes to the stage of equanimity of mind, and he actually says this is a result of transcendental knowledge in the famous Tadvini Pranipatena Pariprashnena, where you should approach a guru. Then in the next verse he says, and when you have received that truth by which you no longer be an illusion again, you will know that all living entities are in me and are mine. So, in other words, seeing everyone as spirit soul, then sort of removes objects of sense desire from the field of consciousness, because they're objects of Krishna's enjoyment, not my enjoyment. So this is what we mean by purification of the mind. And so I think what you've described here is a mind that is functioning still within objects that are supposedly enjoyable to us.
Oh, sure.
And then so the mind becomes attracted, part of the mind, the conscious part of the mind becomes attracted to some sense object. But the mind is inherently, as Krishna also says, dualistic.
Right.
It's chanchala, it's unsteady.
Right.
It's place of duality.
Right.
So that means as we become, as in the process of becoming attracted to something, already the mind somewhere in the mind, the energy for rejecting, because sankalpa vikalpa, the mind accepts and rejects, the energy for rejecting that is already being gathered, is already being collected, so that inevitably you become, as we do, we become frustrated with that sense object, then we have a reason already there, it just pops out. Anyway, she wasn't really pretty, and whatever. I never really was in love with her. Blah, blah, blah. So would you say this is...
Yeah, I never thought of it like that, but I think that's definitely a good way to look at it. I was thinking more just the idea that desire and aversion are two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
That when you desire something, you inherently are...
Well, that's just what I was saying, but I was just...
Right.
There's a process by which the mind does that. Because the same... It's just... I mean, it's a common human experience that the... especially between the sexes in the material world, this phenomenon of love at first sight. You know, but a year down the line, they can't stand the sight of one another. And it's the same... It's all for more or less the same reasons. But just the mind itself has just switched to just reverse poles. The same sensory input is there. It's the same person.
Right.
But all those reasons why in the beginning you were so attracted have now become reasons for the mind's rejection. So there's some... It's like... I was intrigued by this, about energy and The energy is building up.
Yeah.
It seems to be building up.
Yeah, well, that gets into the idea of a complex. So this...
go ahead.
This principle of opposites... He says that this principle of opposites has a regulating effect on the tension. That as tension arises, it exposes the opposite sides. It's trying to bring the opposite desire into the conscious awareness. I think that's the idea with the tension, and it's trying to give rise to the other side, saying, "Hey, what about me?" Now, when one doesn't give proper credence to the opposite side of his psyche, then it's either that this tension arises, or one can repress it, meaning that one takes the opposite desire and represses it into the personal unconscious, so pushes it out of our conscious awareness, so we can't look at it, we can't think about it. It's pushed out of the way, and consequently, often what happens is that we create what's called a persona. So, shadow and persona are kind of the opposites of each other. The shadow is the thing that we can't stand to look at, that we've thrown behind us, and try to get it away from me, and so that becomes our shadow, and consequently, we create a persona or a false impression based on that. Half desire, that desire that's not fully represented in our psyche.
If I can just make a remark of clarification.
Yes, please.
If you've seen, everyone has seen drama, dramatic plays. There's these symbols of the happy mask and the tragic mask. Everyone's seen those two masks, and they always symbolize drama. Those are called technically personas. So the word persona actually means a false front or a mask or a false appearance, that we create ourselves an image that we want everyone to think that I'm like this, but as he's explaining, inside we're different and we have this shadow, the reality following, like that expression probably, the tiger of nescience, one step behind us. The tiger of our own ignorance, our own repressed desires following us.
Right.
And sometimes it attacks us, and in social situations, suddenly someone who is supposed to be a real gentleman or nice lady, she's suddenly screaming and throwing a tantrum, and she's lost control, and everyone's wondering, what's happened? Why did this happen?
I was thinking that persona, we can think of that like, let's say, like the, I don't know if they had this term in when you were younger, but pure devotee syndrome. Mm-hmm. That, person all of a sudden is like just acting like they're, their feet don't touch the ground and their eyes don't blink. But it's very thin. It's quite evident just in itself that it's, there's something missing there. There's something not whole about it. There's something fake about it. And I think to the extent that there's something in the shadow, to that extent the persona will seem very thin and not very convincing. Whereas you see someone who is